We are continuing our survey of the views of the millennium as we have seen them throughout church history, going all the way back to the Apostolic Fathers. Right now, we are in the time of the Reformation and considering the consensus view that kind of came together around the teaching of John Calvin and Theodore Beza, his successor, and the what are known as the Marian exiles, the Reformed Christians from England and Scotland that had to flee their homeland because of Bloody Mary, who was a staunch Roman Catholic. And so summarizing this sort of consensus, the main points that they were all kind of agreeing upon. But I want to quote, I want to read to you a quote from the Irish Times newspaper from the October 22nd, 1996 article. It begins by saying, an early tea could be advisable today. The reason being is because there was a chance that the world might end that day at 6 p.m. That prediction was made by a man by the name of James Usher, who perhaps you might have heard of. But James Usher was not a radical, apocalyptic fanatic. He was not a fringe person, such as some of the Anabaptists that we've considered before, men such as Thomas Munster. No, he was actually an archbishop in the Church of Ireland, a very powerful, well-known, well-respected scholar. He was actually invited to the Westminster Assembly, the documents that we subscribe to as a summary of our belief, the Westminster Confession of Faith and larger and shorter catechisms. James Usher was invited to participate in that assembly. As we'll see, he ended up turning that invitation down. But he was the primary author of what is known as the Irish Articles, which is probably amongst all of the previous confessions of faith that were written, the one that the Westminster Divines used to help them formulate the Westminster Confession of Faith. So you can take the Irish Articles and the Westminster Confession of Faith and see a lot of overlap. James Usher was responsible for that in large part. And so how is it that this man, James Usher, was predicting, making predictions that we know did not come to pass, right? 1996, some of you weren't alive at the time. I was, and I don't think I need to give you a spoiler alert that the world did not end, right? The world did not end on October 22nd, 1996. And so before we continue our consideration of James Usher, and Usher's a fascinating character because he's sort of this transition character who rightly can be considered as holding to a Genevan eschatology even as that view was kind of crumbling about him. But just by way of review, I was summarizing, kind of the main points that due to the teaching of John Calvin and others, that they were kind of coming around and embracing these views with regard to the view of the end times. John Calvin rejected premillennialism. I gave you a quote from his Institutes where he says it's an error that is so childish, it doesn't even need a refutation. And he says, these people who say they limit Christ's reign to only 1,000 years are, bringing shame, reproach, they're casting reproach upon Christ and his kingdom. Why would you limit the kingdom of Christ to 1,000 years, Calvin says? To which I would say, well, I think modern-day premillennialists would say, well, we're not limiting his kingdom. We confess his kingdom continues into eternity, but there's this sort of special kingdom that lasts for 1,000 years. Calvin doesn't seem to interact with that claim. But in no uncertain terms, Calvin rejected premillennialism, as well as this apocalyptic fervor that was going on in the Anabaptist movement, where they were taking over cities, claiming it to be the New Jerusalem, their leaders claiming to be, David or, these Old Testament figures reincarnate. They, of course, Calvin, as all of the magisterial reformers, rejected that as well. But the things that they were most certain about, number one, is that the Pope is the Antichrist. That is most certain. Everyone in the Reformed camp could agree on that. The Pope is the Antichrist. And if he is the Antichrist, then what does that mean as far as New Testament prophecy? Well, the end is near, right? I mean, doesn't Paul talk about in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 about the man of sin? It's interesting. Paul doesn't use the term Antichrist. Only John uses that term in 1 John and in 2 John. That's the only place in Scripture where we find that term Antichrist. But Paul uses the term man of sin. And he talks about how the man of sin needs to be revealed before Jesus comes, right? And when Jesus comes, he'll be destroyed. So there's this sense where it's, okay, well, now that prophecy is, it's being fulfilled in our midst. So all that needs to happen now is Jesus needs to come back, right? But it's not just the Pope as an individual, it's the whole Roman Catholic Church, which is being viewed as a false church, likened to the harlot Babylon in the prophecy or in the book of Revelation. And so there's this need not only to oppose the Antichrist or the Pope as Antichrist, but the whole church, his whole hierarchy, right? This also leads to the next characteristic of Genevan eschatology is this martyrdom identity. This sense where this present age, the time between Christ's first and second coming, is going to be characterized as one of persecution and tribulation and turmoil and of a faithful witness, even at the cost of our own life. Calvin spoke of this 1,000 years as not applying to the eternal blessedness of the church, but only to the various disturbances that awaited the church while still toiling on earth. So notice how Calvin characterizes this 1,000-year time period, which he didn't take literally. He didn't characterize it as a golden age, but various disturbances and toiling on earth. So there's this sense of a church under the cross, as it was often termed. Calvin experienced that. He had to flee his homeland of France. He hosted the Marian exiles, men such as John Knox, men such as John Fox, who wrote not just the Fox's Book of Martyrs, but this whole history of the world. And he's tracing this faithful witness in the face of persecution. And of course, according to Fox, is, okay, this one, this unleashing, this most recent persecution, which is coming upon us through Mary, through Mary's bloody reign, right? He saw as the final unleashing of Satan, and the end was near. So this martyrdom identity, but also this third element of the godly prince. This could be traced one of Calvin's mentors, a man by the name of Martin Bucer, and who preached and taught in Strasbourg, Germany, where Calvin was for a time when he got kicked out of Geneva for a while. He ministered to a French-speaking congregation there in Strasbourg. He said it was the happiest time of his life until Geneva twisted his arm and made him come back. Bucer wrote in this treatise, The Kingdom of Christ. He wrote how it is that Christ reigns over all, but he does so through the godly prince. And he spoke of the duties of the Christian prince. Now here he's thinking Protestant prince, right? Roman Catholic prince would be in league with Antichrist. But in Bucer's mind, as part of this Reformation, the reason why they're called the magisterial reformers is because they look to the civil magistrate, the godly prince, to carry out this reformation of the worship of the church, to put down idolatry, to punish blasphemy, to enforce not just the second table of the law, but the first table of the law, the duties that we have with regard to man. So this doctrine was... it's traced to Martin Bucer, but all of the reformers adopt this. All the magisterial reformers adopt this, including Calvin, where they look to a godly Protestant prince to suppress Roman Catholicism and to enact godly reform within the church. Now, what's interesting is that they're still understanding these two realms, or they spoke of it as two kingdoms, the eternal kingdom of Christ and the temporal kingdom, but they see them working together. So it's a distinction without separation in their minds. Okay. And I mentioned this briefly last week, when Calvin was alive, and when Beza, his successor, when they were ministering in Geneva, a prime candidate for this godly prince was Henry of Navarre, who was an heir to the throne of France. And there was, you know, all of this, war and turmoil within France, but ultimately Henry of Navarre ascended to the throne. And Calvin and Beza were jumping up and down for excitement. Here's our godly prince. We're finally going to be able to reform France, right? Because they were Frenchmen to the heart. But what did Henry of Navarre do when he became Henry VI? He became a Roman Catholic. He said, Paris is worth a mass. He realized that things would go much more smoothly for him if he just became a Roman Catholic. And there it was Calvin and Beza's hopes dashed against the stone. No longer is he godly prince, right? But he's in league with the Antichrist. Even though they kept corresponding with him, and Beza wrote to him and says, you need to be like David and be a godly prince. And this, you know, they were trying their best to piece it together, but such disappointment that they experienced. Okay, so these three things, and we could add a bit more, and I'm gonna tack one more on, which is interesting. These three, the Pope is Antichrist, a martyrdom identity, and the godly prince rule, are kind of the three hallmarks of what we might call Genevan eschatology, as people kind of came around this view. But you do notice, and I mentioned this last time, that there's a bit of a tension between this martyrdom identity and this godly prince idea. Because what if you get that godly prince? What if you have somebody like Edward I in England, who allows the reform of the church, right? What do you do then? You lose that martyrdom identity, right? If your man is in charge, no longer are you going to be persecuted. So it's this tension of having this martyrdom identity, the sense that, yes, the time between Christ's first and second coming is going to be characterized by a faithful witness in the face of persecution, but also this hope that, well, if we could just get our guy or gal in charge, then maybe things would be better, right? Do you recognize that tension there? So these are kind of competing ideas. So this is, as I said, this is how things were in and around Geneva as the magisterial reformers were articulating this view. You'll recall that those exiles from England, men such as John Fox and John Knox and others, come to Geneva are reading and understanding this. And then they're taking that back after Mary dies. Of course, you have Elizabeth, who's Protestant, who allows Protestants back in, who has this time where you have this godly princess now, in charge. As this Genevan eschatology makes its way back to the British Isles, it does so primarily through a Bible, an English Bible translation known as the Genevan Bible. Has anyone ever heard of the Genevan Bible? Okay. So the Genevan Bible, it's a bit of a misnomer because there isn't just one Genevan Bible. There's multitude of copies, versions of the Genevan Bible, not just the translation, but what is characteristic of the Genevan Bible is that there are annotations, there are notes on the bottom of each page explaining the passage above. So many of you probably have study Bibles, right? I purchased... if you're familiar with the Reformation Study Bible. Does anyone have that one, the Reformation Study Bible? It's a great, great copy, great version. When Ligonier Ministries first published that, it was known as the New Genevan Bible. And so I have a New Geneva Bible I bought years back. So same idea, same idea is that you have the English translation of the passage, of the scriptures, but then there's explanations of the passage below, which is helpful. And it's kind of the way in which the reformers were able to find this balance of translating the scriptures into the vernacular, into the language, the common language of people, so that every man and woman could have the Bible in their hands and they could read it for themselves, right? Something that Rome was like, no way. We can't do that. Why? Because you're going to have a million Luthers and everyone's going to have their own interpretation, right? The reformers are like, no, we want the Bible in people's hands in a language they can understand. But they also didn't want to have those crazy Anabaptists running around claiming their own private interpretation. So how do you find this balance? Well, you give the Bible to people in a language they could read, but you have notes on the bottom to help them understand. That make sense? So I think it's still a good practice. We still do it today. Many of you, your own Bibles have that. But here's an interesting thing. As far as these views, all of these views are found in the original Genevan Bibles as they made their way back to the British Isles. But one extra thing got added that Calvin did not teach. From Romans 11, salvation of all Israel. This would become a hallmark of an end times view as it made its way to the British Isles, and it's sort of enshrined in the Genevan Bible, this understanding not of Revelation chapter 20, but of Romans chapter 11, which we're going to get to real soon on Sunday mornings. In the sermons, where Paul says, and so all Israel will be saved. Calvin's understanding of that is that Paul's speaking of spiritual Israel there, Jew and Gentile. So the fullness of Israel, the fullness of the Jew, the fullness of the Gentiles, all Israel is saved. That was Calvin's view. Beza, however, understood it to refer to ethnic Israel, and that there would be, before the coming of Christ, in the last days, a mass conversion of Jewish people. That was Beza's understanding. And that view made its way into the Genevan Bible, which made its way to the British Isles, which kind of got tacked on to this Genevan eschatology. Very interesting. Any questions or comments? I'll pause there. Any questions or comments? So far. Okay. Let's now jump to James Usher, who was a man who embraced these and is kind of is very, very influential, but also is sort of a transitional figure because things are going to kind of change during his lifetime. So James Usher, let me erase this real quick. His dates are 1581, 16 through 1656. So he lived a long life, relatively speaking, for that time. Saw a lot in his day. As I said, top-notch scholar. He's known for many things, including the Irish Articles. He was made Archbishop of Armagh. I don't have an Irish dialect, so I don't know if I pronounce it. Let me know how to pronounce it when you get back from your trip. Archbishop of Armagh, he stayed in that position of power till his death. Very well known, very influential. It's kind of, was a big mover and shaker in the Church of England. He's most well known, and probably his biggest life, his magnum opus, would be, it had a Latin name, but it was the Annals of the World. So basically, he wrote an entire world history, going all the way back to creation. And if you're tracing world history and you find the beginning, then what is that? What does that necessarily mean? You got to tell about the end, right? So his history turns into an eschatology. We've already seen this with John Fox, right? John Fox wrote this history of martyrdom, right, and a faithful witness in the face of persecution, culminating in this in the end, right? So Usher adds his name to this list of people who attempt to write a world history. And his main purpose for this is to answer the Roman Catholic objection, where was your church before Martin Luther? Where was your church? See, the Roman Catholic objection to the Reformers is novelty. You guys are trying to start a new church. Before Luther, there was no church. You only have the Roman Catholic Church, right? That was their objection. You still see that today, by the way. And Usher wants to respond by saying, no, our church has been there all along. And let me show you the history, right? And that history is characterized by a faithful witness. So he goes back throughout church history. He goes to the early church fathers. He's appealing to this idea that, the true church has been there all along. And this is part of it. But as I said, he takes us all the way back to creation, and he gets pretty specific. He dates the day of creation as October 22nd. Oops. uh, 4004 BC. That's the date of creation, according to James Usher. Which, you know, you could do the math. Well, actually, maybe some of you math majors are thinking, like, well, wait a minute. So we have this date of creation, right? 4,000 years before the birth of Christ. So, we all know that Jesus wasn't born at AD 0, right? In all likelihood, he was probably born in 4 BC. We were dating Herod the Great, like, when he was, according to Luke, right? And so Usher even knew that, right? And so he's... going back 4,000 years, he had the building of the temple at the year 3,000, 1,000 years before the birth of Christ, okay, or 3,004. And then he's also adopting this day-age view that the world, the history of the world, will be 6,000 years, right? And then culminating in the 7,000 the 7,000 year being the Sabbath. So we've already seen this. This goes back to the early church fathers. There's people holding these views. So if he goes back to 4004 BC for the date of creation, wouldn't that put us at 2004 for the end of the world, right? Well, those of you who know British history know that the Brits were pretty late in adopting the Julian calendar. Their years were shorter than ours. Their years were not 365. So British history gets really complicated because their year, right? I mean, their 1656. Actually, no, I think this is our 1656. But this wouldn't be 1656 for Usher. Complicated. Go just Google it and you can figure it out, okay? But that's where you're getting to 1996 or 1997, okay? All right. Putting all that aside, Usher felt like he knew the beginning of the world. October 22nd, 4004, and therefore was able to project the end of the world. It's interesting that he didn't say it was going to be in his day. Right? This is also another thing that's common, where everyone thinks the end of the world's going to happen when they're alive. Because, of course, Jesus is going to come back, because we're the most important people in church history, right? No, Usher says, no, it's out there. It's out there. Another guy who we'll talk about in the coming weeks, John Brightman, said, no, the end of the world's not going to happen until 2300. So we still got a few hundred, we got some time before Jesus comes back, according to Brightman. All right. Like Calvin, James Usher characterized the millennium. Well, first of all, like Calvin, Usher said that the millennium began at the coming of Christ, either at his birth or his death, or even he said that some people date it at AD 70, which, what happened in AD 70, by the way? destruction of Jerusalem, destruction of the temple, which Jesus predicted in Matthew 24, right? He doesn't want to get too specific, nor does he want to be too tied to a literal 1,000 years, but he believes that it began at some point after the birth of Christ, okay? And also, like Calvin, Usher characterized this age between Christ's first and second coming as marked chiefly by tribulations. So he spoke of this faithful remnant that stood in the face of persecution as his objection, or as his response to the Roman Catholic objection, where was your church before Luther? He says, there's always been a faithful remnant. And so he speaks of this faithful remnant in the early days of the church. He said, they grew by persecutions and were crowned by martyrdoms. Their first bishops, writing as a bishop, he'd have no problem with saying they're bishops, right? Remember, he's a bishop. Their first bishops were content with holy laurels of martyrdom, which they esteemed better than any diadem or scepter. Their glory was ignominy, majesty, humility, happiness, tyrant's anger, rest, punishment, life, death itself. So there's this ironic twist that you see in Calvin, that we saw going back even to people like Polycarp, right, who talked about in our dying, in our faithful witness, in even loving our lives not unto death, that's where victory is. Doesn't Jesus say, he who overcomes, I will let him sit on my throne even as my Father has let me sit on the throne, right? It doesn't Revelation 20 talk about the souls of those who had been beheaded, who come to life and rule and reign with Christ, right? So they're focusing on that, not the glory, but the martyrdom, which gets you there. Now, here's where things get a little complicated. For Calvin, he thought that this 1,000-year reign was symbolic of the time between Christ's first and second coming. For Usher, he saw the millennium begin at the coming of Christ, but actually he says the millennium has come and gone. And that the end of the millennium, which was characterized by persecution, has ended. The end of the millennium was signaled as the church, especially its bishops, its hierarchy, gained temporal power. As the church began assuming power over not just the keys of the kingdom, but over the civil realm, that's what Usher identifies as an attack of Satan. It's been said, you know, Satan realized he couldn't defeat the church through persecution, so he joined the church. And that added, you know, that resulted in the church gaining, the Roman Catholic Church gaining this temporal power and ultimately being corrupted. He saw this as Satan's biggest attack. So for him, any sort of golden age, any sense where things are going to get better, are going to be good for the church, for Usher, that was firmly in the future. Brings up a very interesting thing. Usher spoke of not one, but two millenniums. One that began at the coming of Christ and ended around 1300 AD, and one which is yet future, which he was understanding to begin with the Reformation. And he's not alone in this view. I mentioned this guy by the name of John Brightman, who spoke of two millenniums, one in the past and one in the future. Now, again, remember our views, all-mill, post-mill, pre-mill? How do you classify that? Dual mill, I guess? I mean, you know, you understand how how we want to pigeonhole people and kind of say, like, well, are you all-mill, post-mill, or pre-mill? Well, I mean, look at church history. There's a lot of diversity there. So this is a fascinating development where you have a millennium in the past and a millennium in the future, one characterized by persecution and suffering, another one characterized by glory, right? You kind of get the best of both worlds. You kind of get to have your cake and eat it too, right? And that's Usher's kind of unique Well, not entirely unique, because he's building this off of this guy Brightman. But do you understand how that can now lead to a shift where it says, well, maybe what you understood as the millennium in the past, maybe that wasn't the millennium that John's speaking of in Revelation 20. Maybe the millennium is yet future. So that opens up from what we might call an all-mill view to the possibility of having a pre-mill and post-mill view, where there's this view where there's wait until things get better, right? And that's exactly what's going to happen in Usher's lifetime and amongst Usher's disciples. There's going to be a resurgence of premillennialism, okay? Men such as Joseph Mead, men such as William Twiss, who was the moderator of the Westminster Assembly. Not fringe guys. These are well-known, respected guys. Okay, so that was Usher's contribution. Okay, so we're going to pause there. I'm going to pause there, see if there's any questions or comments. Yes, David. Yeah, you know, I'm not delving into the primary sources. I would be really interested to see if Usher interacted with that verse. Because Jesus says, "No man knows," you know, not even the Son of Man, right? In his human nature, Jesus didn't even know. I'd be interested to see if Usher. I'm sure he did. I'm sure he read that. Yeah. Yep. Yes. Yeah, you'd think, right? And this also, okay. So this is another thing. Another hallmark of this view of the time with regard to the Book of Revelation itself. So interpretation of the Book of Revelation is, by and large, people adopt what could be termed a historicist view of the Book of Revelation. That is, the Book of Revelation is history written in advance. So the whole idea is to figure out, well, where are we in the Book of Revelation? What chapter are we in? How close are we to chapter 20 and 21, the final chapters, right? And so there's this idea to sort of trace, to look to the Book of Revelation and to say, okay, well, this event, it corresponds to this time in church history. So this kind of history written in advance, historicist interpretation, I think maybe gave people confidence that they thought, well, okay, well, here God is revealing that to us. Maybe at the time when Jesus said, no man knows, well, they didn't know at the time because Revelation wasn't written yet. So I'm just assuming, I don't know if this would be Usher's response to that, but that's definitely, by and large, the way in which they read the Book of Revelation as history written in advance, and then you got to just trace it out, right? Dawn. Well, I mean, I read to you from the Irish Times, which, you know, advised early tea that day, right? I guess they're Irish, so it wouldn't be a British accent, but Usher actually, I mean, for what Usher is known for, the reason why we respect him, and, you know, it's not his eschatology, that's safe to say. And actually, he was a top-notch scholar. Like, for him to be able to, write this chronicle of the history of the entire world, he was reading other ancient Near Eastern documents. He did work, textual criticism in Ignatius of Antioch. So at that time, there was this alleged letters and writings of Ignatius, and he was reading it. He says, this doesn't sound like it. He did more in-depth textual criticism and came to the conclusion that what was ascribed to Ignatius was not, you know, only certain stuff we have was authentic, and that's still scholarly consensus to this day. His brother, Ambrose, was a top-notch Hebraicist in he spoke Arabic, he translated stuff. It's just amazing stuff. He's a pretty remarkable guy. His uncle was a Roman Catholic Jesuit priest. So, you know, imagine Thanksgiving, you know, at their dinner table. And he lived in Ireland, so he was in the midst of that conflict, right? This, you know, war with Antichrist. He was right there with it. But as we'll see, we're going to have to stop here, but we'll pick up with Usher's story and kind of see where he realizes sort of the writing's on the wall as far as his understanding of how things are going to go. So let's go ahead and close with prayer. Dear Lord Jesus Christ, we do thank you for the fact that your kingdom will have no end. We thank you that we have the privilege of being citizens of your kingdom. And of course, none of us by nature deserve this. We thank you for your sovereign grace that we did not choose you, but you chose us. We thank you, Lord, for the privilege we have to be able to call upon your name, knowing that whoever calls upon your name will be saved. Bless us this week as we go about our daily lives and gather us together again as we call upon your name. And we ask all this in your name. Amen.